renormalization. That'll be very informal. So the outline of my talk today and tomorrow is this: to understand some of the organizational principles behind renormalization, you have to understand what a one-particle irreducible diagram is. And I think Francois has touched upon that topic, so I'll just review that quickly. And then some of those diagrams in order by order in perturbation theory are going to be divergent, and which diagrams are divergent or not, you can kind of, you know, there's a rough kind of organization scheme labeling the diagrams according to the divergences. And that there's a quantity called the superficial degree of divergence. I'll introduce that for QED. And then you know, we'll see that in four dimensions, QED has, at every order in perturbation theory, a finite number of divergent diagrams. And then I'll do the dimensional regularization of QED. And there are some very technical results one needs to use, some technical results of some integrations. And I'll get to that today. But the dimensional regularization of QED, I think we'll start on that tomorrow. And then I'll do the, once you regularize the infinities, we will do a renormalization by using counterterms with the minimal subtraction prescription. There are different subtraction prescriptions, but you know, the one that I'll use is called the minimal subtraction. And then, you know, as an application of renormalization, we'll calculate the beta function of QED. That is how the electric charge or the coupling constant of QED depends on the energy scale at which you're probing the theory. And then, if time permits, I'll outline how you can do the beta function calculation of QCD, but probably we won't get the time. This is a very famous calculation because it has a sign, different sign, compared to the beta function of this one, and that minus sign, you know, which is what leads to asymptotic freedom. And some of the people who got the Nobel Prize for computing that got the sign wrong first. And they only realized that they had made the sign error when they talked to the other guy who had computed it independently. And then they came back and said, ah, there's the error. So they published it and they both got the Nobel Prize. All right. So what are the one-particle irreducible diagrams? Sorry, this is the organization of the blackboard is kind of funky today. All right. So the one particle irreducible, or one PI, one perimeter institute, sometimes also known as proper vertices, so they are basically the they're the subclass of the connected endpoint functions. So you already saw the endpoint functions. Now, if you have a, you know, Feynman diagram representation of these endpoint functions, they're the subclass of the endpoint functions in which, you know, if you cut an internal line, an internal Feynman propagator, a bare propagator, then the diagram doesn't fall into two parts, right? They are the one, the proper vertices. For example, an example could be like this guy, right? So there's an internal line here. So if you cut it, but it doesn't fall into two pieces. Whereas, you know, if you have a higher order diagram like this, you know, if you cut it here, then it does, you know, fall into two pieces. So you're only allowed to cut once through an internal line. So this is an example of a 1PI, and that's not a 1PI, right? Now, the general discussion that I'll present in a moment of how to think of on a field theory in terms of 1 PI, I will use a scalar field theory for that. But our first example of 1 PI, I will actually use an example from QED. So consider the QED propagator. So you have the propagator. You have some momentum going like this. And then be still. There's some one loop correction to it. And then there will be another kind of a two loop correction of this order, of this structure, and stuff like that. But then there will also be two loop corrections of this type. And then each of these photon lines will have an internal fermion loop. So the way I have organized this is that the first line consists of diagrams which contribute to the 1 PI. So I can now represent this thing, the propagator to all orders, as the bare propagator, and then something with a blob, which is the summation of all these guys, all the 1 PI at each order, and then summation of these guys and then so on and so forth. So So if we define by gamma of p by I, by the way, I won't be very fussy about overall factors i's and minus ones. Hopefully they'll keep things, this won't lead to any major problem. So if I define that to be the inverse of the free propagator, applied to that series. So in other words, we can represent that as just the blob, but without any external legs attached to it. Then that series that I wrote up there can be written in terms of equation as the exact Feynman propagator. So I should probably put an F here. The first term is nothing but the free propagator, so this has some p dependence. And the second term and then the third term is just an it. God, this is. Right? So this is what it is. But if you pull like a factor of the free propagator out, this is nothing but a geometric series. Formally, at least, may not be because we'll see that these guys are actually divergent. So, but formally we can write this as some kind of a geometric series. But they won't be divergent once we actually regularize them.
Right.
Okay. So then we can write the exact Feynman propagator to be I times, now we plug in the value of the free propagator, P slash minus M minus sigma of P plus. The epsilon prescription, I will write it as 0 plus, because we'll use the epsilon, the symbol epsilon for something else, okay? So, by the way, I think you guys have seen this, right? The representation of the free propagator like this, right? You know, you can just then multiply the denominator and the numerator by the same stuff and then get P slash right? But you know, a lot of times the fermion propagator is written just as a matrix in the denominator. Okay, okay, so if you now look at this guy, this is the exact propagator, right? And the M was the parameter which entered your Lagrangian, but according to the you know the analysis of the Chalin-Lehmann right representation, you know that the pole of the propagator is where the physical mass should be. So your physical mass is given by this value. So it's a pole of this guy. So this motivates us to call this object as the electron self-energy. So the definition of the two-point one-particle irreducible which you know we'll write as gamma 2 of P in momentum space is that it's the inverse of the two-point connected Green's function, or which is also the Feynman propagator, the exact Feynman, the propagator, okay? So it's, so the definition of the two-point one particle irreducible is, and there's a factor of I to make things consistent. So in other words, this object is our P slash minus M minus sigma of P. Now, just as the you know connected Green's function, say for arbitrary number of arguments, this was generated by some object called some W, right? It was the log of your partition function, Z, right? So Just like that was generated, the connected greens function was generated by W, there is an object which generates the endpoint one particle irreducible diagrams. And that object is called the effective action. And so the effective action, we write it as it's some functional of some field phi. So now I'm kind of switching to a case where we are actually to the context of a scalar field theory. The discussion for something involving fermions and photons is more involved, but it's a straightforward generalization. Okay, so this is the effective action. And I think Francois also discussed this in quite detail, but I'm going to present this in a different way now. And it's actually related to our W through a Legendre transformation. So, here I will, by dx, I will mean d4x. So I can't be bothered to write 4. And the whole idea of a Legendre transformation is that, if you have, it preserves the relationship between your independent and dependent variables, right? So that when you are actually going to a new description of the system, you don't lose any information. So my claim is that this guy defined by this equation, so in terms of W, will generate what I'm calling a one-particle irreducible diagrams. And I will show that now. So, there are two definitions, it seems, of gamma 2. One is defined like this. The other one is that it should be somehow generated from this. Let's see that these two things are consistent. So, in other words, let's, this guy, this should be given by something like this. Right? Because that's what a generating function does, right? And we'll have to show that this object is essentially the Fourier transform of this. Okay. So given that definition, the relationship between phi and j is given by like this. So you can derive this. By now, you guys must be like masters of taking functional derivatives, right? Right. Now, the definition of the connected two-point function, by the way, formally it's a function of x and y by Lorentz invariance, well, by Poincaré invariance, it should be a function of x minus y, right? And according to my definition, there is a minus I here. I don't know if that's consistent with Francois' notation, but that's not very important. Right? So this is basically what the two-point function is. The two-point function, connected two-point function, is generated from the W by taking the by taking two functional derivatives with respect to the source J, sources J. But then now using this formula in this equation, we can write this as minus I delta of phi of y by delta of j of x. So similarly, from this thing, again, we write this as a function of x minus y by Poincaré invariance. And then using this definition, we have so this, the claim is that this guy and this guy should be inverse of each other. And it seems like that's going to be the case, you know. So all we have to do now is to take them and put them inside an integral. Be a little careful about their arguments, because you can think of these guys as, you know, infinite dimensional matrices. And then what you do is you match up the matrix index, and you sum over that index, and then now you use this relationship, like the expression for this given here and the expression for this given here, and they give you delta of x minus y. So this is essentially nothing but the real space version of the formula that I wrote down earlier. Right. Now let's look at how the 3.1 PI is related to the 3-point connected Green's function. So after that, I'll just like say, you know, this is physicist proof. After that, I'll say, well, this kind of thing. Then I'll draw a diagram for the 4-point function. And then I'll say, this proves my claim. If you want to look at general proof, I think there are books on renormalization by Collins. You can look those things up. Okay, front. So before we move on to the 3.1 PIs, note that, you know, if you take a, oh my God, what's happening to our chalks? I think we are buying substandard chalks these days, cutting costs, you know. Somebody has to pay for the coffee, so. What's happening to education in Canada, right? Okay. So the functional derivative with respect to J is, we use the chain rule. So you can express the functional derivative with J in terms of functional derivative with respect to phi. So now we take the functional derivative of that equation over there, which states that the two-point function the connected two-point Green's function is the inverse of the two-point one-particle irreducible. If you apply this guy, the right-hand side doesn't have any j's or phi's, so the right-hand side goes to 0. The left-hand side, we can now break up what these guys actually stand for. And then we get two terms, because we have to use Leibniz, because a functional derivative is nothing but a fancy form of partial derivative. So we get, the first term we get is three derivatives of W with respect to J. This guy stays as it is. This, and then the second term is the first guy stays as it is. The second thing now, now we use this handy identity, and I think I forgot an I here. And we get d of c 2 x prime minus y prime delta, the third derivative of gamma. Y prime delta y. Phi of y, del phi of z, and this thing is equal to 0. I hope I haven't made any mistakes, but I want to vouch on it. Right. So now we can multiply this equation by, so we multiply by the two-point connected Green's function and integrate over z, then what we get is the following. So this, then we get this guy, the integral so this thing, and then delta of j of x prime, delta of j of x, delta of j of y. And because we multiplied by an inverse of the 2.1 particle irreducible, we got a delta function. And then there's the I that I, and then that's right. And this, on the other side, we have minus of I dy dy prime dz. And now we have three factors of connected Green's function. Multiplying the third derivative of our effective action and then we can now use this delta function to do the y derivative, and then we have the final formula that we were looking for, which is the third derivative of W with respect to the source J is given by applying the two-point function three times to the third derivative of the effective action. So graphically, we can represent it in this following way. So the left-hand side is basically the three-point connected Green's function. And the right-hand side is, you know, something which has with a two-point Green's function attached to its leg. Okay. So if you want, you can invert this. So by multiplying now, say, both sides with gamma 2 and then integrating over the arguments and then using the fact that gamma 2 is the inverse of the two-point, you know, Green's function, you can invert that relationship. And you can write that the that this thing x1, x2 is, I think there's a minus sign. X1 minus Y1 and then you apply 3-point function. So all these algebra is to kind of convince you that morally speaking, the connected Green's function and the 3-point one particle irreducible diagram are they're the same object. Now you can take the derivative of this equation, and don't worry, I'm not going to do that right now. And you can express the four particle connected Green's function in terms of the one particle irreducible diagrams. And if you go through that, you will find something like this. So there will be a part which will be the four-particle irreducible, the four-point one-particle irreducible diagram, and then the lower, the three-particle irreducible diagram. The three-point one-particle irreducible diagram will show up in this way. And all the other combination, the So these are the two particle, Green's connected Green's function. So, in this expansion, this is a one particle irreducible function diagram. This is a one particle irreducible diagram. This one is. So what was the point of doing all this exercise? The point of this exercise is that to kind of try to convince you that whatever correlation function, connected correlation function you look at, you can always organize that in terms of one particle irreducibles of that order and lower order. Now, if the divergences, so that when you have divergences in quantum field theory, they will be concentrated on some of these one particle irreducible diagrams. That if you can fix the divergences or regularize or renormalize the divergences of the one particle irreducible diagrams, that will ensure that your Green's connected Green's functions are finite. Okay, so this is to drive home the point that the one particle irreducible diagrams are the important things. Okay, the other thing you also want to kind of think about is that if you can keep on doing this, and if you find that in the quantum field theory that you're interested in, the one particle irreducible, there are an infinite number of one particle irreducible diagrams, which are divergent, then you can be sure that such a theory will not be renormalizable. And that's because we'll see that, at the end of the day, some of the physical parameters in which we will absorb the infinities are given by, they are related to the one particle irreducible diagrams order by order in perturbation theory, and if there are an infinite number of divergent diagrams, you basically will have to redefine an infinite number of scattering amplitudes to actually absorb those infinities, and such a theory is not renormalizable. Okay, so That took longer than I thought it would, but there are some, a few typos in the lecture notes, which I'll fix. So now let's talk about the divergent diagrams in QED. So so by now, you have seen that at one loop, QED, QCD, phi to the power 4 theory, all of these guys have divergent contributions, right? They're Feynman diagrams. If you apply the Feynman rules, you get infinities. So what can we do? One of the options is to actually say that, well, forget about higher loops. We don't need higher loops. So let's just keep to, tree-level diagrams. But the problem is that you don't get good agreement with experiments if you do that. So for example, in QED, if you just look at the tree-level diagrams, you will get predictions which are contradicted by precision experiments. So, and you might think that, you might want to explain these differences between prediction and experiment by saying, invoking new physics, but there are no new, there is no new physics there. So the only conclusion that we can reach is that these differences between the tree-level prediction and observation is due to higher loops. So you have to consider higher loops. So if you're gonna, if you have a theory, you have to take it seriously. So we organize the discussion on divergent diagrams according to a quantity called D, which is called the superficial degree of divergence. And it's called superficial not because we are superficial people. I mean, we are superficial people, but that's not why it's called superficial. It's called superficial because a lot of times, the degree of divergence, the kind of divergence that this degree of divergence will predict is not actually the divergence you will get when you actually examine the diagram very carefully. However, this is a good rule of thumb and also a way to see whether, quickly see whether a theory is going to be renormalizable or not in perturbation theory. So, a diagram in QED, so let's, let's think in D dimensions. So if there are L loops in a diagram, that diagram is going to give you D powers of, in the momentum integral, right? So every momentum integral will have D to the power P. And if you have L loops, there'll be, L independent momentum integrals to do. So, the more of these momentum integrals you have, the more divergent your diagram will be, right? However, internal rinds and the propagators, they come to a rescue. They decrease the degree of divergence. So, photons, the internal photons have two factors of momentum in the denominator. So they decrease the degree of divergence by two, each internal photon line. So P, but each internal electron line just decreases the divergence by one. Okay. Now consider a diagram which has n vertices. So the number of independent momentum to be integrated over, so the number of independent momenta, number which is the same as the number of loops, will be the number of internal lines minus, at if you have n vertices, at each vertex we are going to preserve, have a momentum conservation. So that's going to get rid of n of our momenta. But all these momenta are actually related to each other by an overall momentum conservation, which we multiply to our matrix element to get the cross section. So the number of independent momenta is going to be given by the number of internal lines and minus n plus 1, where n is the number of vertices. So in other words, L is P I E I minus n plus 1. So in the case of QED, each vertex gives you 2 fermion lines and 1 photon line. But if one of the fermion line is in the external state, that is counted once. But if it's in the internal state, that counts for twice. So for each vertex, we get 2 fermion lines, which is one is an external and 2 count as internal electrons. Similarly, for photons, we only get 1 per vertex. So these guys allow us to eliminate the internal number of photon lines and the internal number of electron lines for external number of photon and external number of electron lines. And if you do the algebra, just a few lines, you get this. The superficial degree of divergence is related to the dimension of space-time plus n d by 2 minus 2. And there's a minus sign, d minus 1 by 2, the e external minus d minus 2 by 2 p external. So when d is 4, big D is 4 minus 2 . So this means that the more external photons and electrons we get, they come with minus signs, right? So that means our d minus 1, 4, that should be a 3, right? Wait. So that means that in QED, in 4 dimension, there are only going to be a finite number of divergent diagrams. Now, if we went to a higher dimension, in higher dimension, this term would not be 0, and this term has positive coefficient, and and it has n in it. That means that no matter how many external photons and how many external electrons you have, if you go to high enough order in perturbation theory, you're going to find some new diagrams which are going to be divergent. Right? So this shows that in higher dimensions, QED, a theory like QED will not be renormalizable. Okay? Now, if you had done this similar analysis, but for, say, in phi to the power r theory in four dimensions, then the degree of divergence for that theory turns out to be again, the term that is troubling now comes with a coefficient of r minus 4. That means that if you had considered phi to the power 5 theory, or you know anything with where the interaction term had a higher power than 4, then your then that theory would have an infinite number of divergent diagrams. So this shows that you know in scalar field theory, only phi to the power 4 theory, up to phi to the power 4 theory is renormalizable.
But didn't you have that thing that if you put more interaction terms, the couplings would invert, like they wouldn't be important anymore and they would just disappear when we normalize?
So you're saying that if I have, if I have phi to the power 6, that somehow, so yeah, in the low energy limit, you know, that diagram is not going, you know, contribution from those kind of, you know, interaction terms would be suppressed. But the point of renormalization is that there are divergences coming from the UV of your theory. So it's really a high energy, in the high energy, you know, so, and in any theory there in which has, you know, terms like this, they would not be, you know, that, you know, as you go higher and, you know, in the higher energy regime, they would actually, you know, give you divergent answers. So, but you're right. I mean, if you had some cutoff, and so I think, yeah, basically what you're thinking about is that, you know, the effect of such, you know, higher order interaction terms
is irrelevant
as you go in low energy. But in renormalization, we are really worried about, you know, more of the, you know, high energy behavior of a theory. Yeah?
Like, if we have a renormalizable theory.
Right, right.
Is it, like, necessary, like, sick in certain case? I mean, like, in IR, we cannot do perturbations.
Right.
But does it mean that this theory has, like, just a nonsense?
Sorry, what's the question?
I mean, suppose we have a non-renormalizable theory. Okay, can it be like a valid theory? But I mean, not as an effective theory, but as a like as a valid.
Right. No, I mean, you know, there are renormalizable theories, non-renormalizable theories, and they are useful.
Yes.
You know, it's but you know, you basically think of them as, I mean, they're also useful, non-renormalizable theories.
Yes.
But for example, you know, if you think about, you know, Fermi's theory for weak interaction, you know, that's a non-renormalizable theory.
Yes.
But at some point, you know, that theory will break down, and usually, you know, that so for arbitrary energy scale, such a theory will not be give you, you know, unitary, like it will not be unitary, right? It, you know, at some point. So if you keep that in mind and you say, okay, I'm going to work in certain energy range and I'm going to only treat this theory as describing my physics in that particular energy range, then that's fine. But the point is that if you want a theory which will have, so, you know, at some point you'll have to replace that theory by something more fundamental.
Yes,
right?
But so do we require the UV completing theory to be renormalized?
Right, yeah. If you, that's the UV completion of, you want that to be a renormalizable theory. Otherwise, you know, that'll probably require another UV completion, right? So I'm not exactly getting what your question is.
Because I don't understand why we really need a theory to be renormalizable. Because the reason
right.
seems that we just want to do perturbations, and perturbations are usually not, like, always true.
Right. I think, you know, you're asking probably a very deep philosophical questions about renormalization, and that I'll have to think a lot about to answer, because you're asking about theories which are not perturbative, right?
Because, like, in my impression, that all the things we done in renormalization is like draw diagrams, and although there's infinity, but we just say, well, this infinity, they actually equals to some, like, some finite values. So we can use this finite values to cancel those infinity.
Right, right.
Yeah, but so that's basically saying that we just require this infinity to be a finite value. So in certain sense, we don't have to, like, have a, like, renormalizability in this case. We can just say, in any case, we just want this thing to be a finite value, and then we put it back and do some, like, magic, and then throw it, like, infinity.
Right. Yeah, so, and the question is, okay, that's exactly what we do. And, but I'm not exactly sure what, you know, why.
Like, in that case, why would we need renormalizability?
Why would we need renormalizability? Right, so okay, if you knew what energy scale your theory broke down at, right, then you would not need renormalizability. You can just say that, you know, in perturbation theory, you're always carrying around some cutoff, because around that cutoff, your theory is not going to be valid, right? And then everything you have, all the perturbation theory business that you have, everything will be fine, right? And that, in that sense, you know, you're fine. But suppose you don't know where your theory is. Its range of validity ends, right? And we know that QED merges with a bigger theory, but it still sits in that theory, and that theory, the QED is still a valid theory. You know, we do believe that it's going to be a low energy effective theory of some higher theory, say some grand unified theory, but we don't know what that theory is. And we don't know when that theory comes into play. You know, we have some indication that, you know, it's some ridiculously high energy, like what, 10 to the power, what, 15 GeV or something at the grand unified scale. But that's kind of a, you know, we don't know directly where that is. So given that circumstance, and also, you know, given this state of situation, you want to have a theory which doesn't have a clear cutoff, but you want that theory to be valid independent of a direct knowledge of that cutoff. Right? So that's when renormalization becomes important, because you want to deal with these pesky infinities, because you can't really put in a cutoff there. But you still want your physics to be, you know, at like the scale of electron energy, several electron volts or MeV, to be independent of what's happening at the Planck scale or at the gut scale, right? And the renormalization actually becomes like is a good way of doing this. In some sense, renormalization is the reason why we can do physics without knowing everything. For example, you know, when we do classical physics, we are not even aware of these, you know, of the microscopic, the ultraviolet completion of classical physics, right? And the philosophy behind renormalization is the same. In classical physics, of course, there aren't any divergences, but the philosophy is that you should be able to do classical physics without knowing too much about what the underlying UV completion of that is. And renormalizable theories allow you to do that, okay? Sorry, that's hand-wavy enough, probably, yeah. All right, so I have very little time left. I thought Francois had answered all these philosophical questions. Why are you asking me? That should have been my answer. So there are two parts to renormalization. The first one is to regulate the infinities. And the second part is actually absorbing those infinities in physical quantities. So the first part is regularization. And there So there are many different ways of regularizing. I think in Francois's lectures you saw a hard cutoff, momentum cutoff, where you know you just cut off the integration up to some scale. And then there's Pauli-Villars. There is where you introduce some kind of fictitious heavy particle. And then there's the lattice QCD where you basically, you know, because your ultraviolet divergences come from short distance fluctuation, you basically discretize space-time. And the lattice regularization and renormalization scheme is inherently non-perturbative. So for example, you know, Huda was saying something about non-perturbative, you know, quantum field theories. So QCD, for example, at low energy, at the level of protons and, you know, and neutrons and mesons, it's actually non-perturbative. You know, the coupling constant is pretty large. So you cannot actually do perturbation theory and get, you know, sensible results. And for those, you know, for in that energy regime, the lattice QCD approach is the right way to go about. And then there is what we will use is called the dimensional regularization. It turns out that a lot of the QFTs that we are interested in four dimensions, the momentum integral, which are divergent, they become convergent if you analytically continue the result to D minus epsilon dimensions. So that's basically what we are going to do. So often we will, so now, you know, the next half an hour or so, I will just do some very, very some very boring but technical stuff, which is absolutely necessary. Actually, I think I'll be done in 15 minutes or so. So, you know, often when you're doing these loop integrals, you come across integrals of this form, right? So let's, in D dimensions, so you have some D dimensional momentum squared minus some dot product between the D dimensional momentum and T and Q, and some mass parameter maybe. And the denominator has some power alpha, where alpha is some, you know, positive constant. Usually it's an integer. So a lot of times you have to deal with integrals like this. So the question is, how do you deal with them? So we go to moment to polar coordinates in momentum space. That means we introduce a time-like direction, some radial direction, a polar angle. That's a polar angle or azimuthal angle? That's a polar angle. No, that's an azimuthal angle. And then if we are in D dimension, we have D minus 3 polar angles, right? And our D dimensional momentum then has a time part, a time-like part, I should say, and spatial part. And our momentum integral then has a part which is the integral over the time-like part, and then the r to the power d minus 2 from the radial part, and then we have the azimuthal angle d phi, and then a string of sine theta k's. So this is our measure. And p goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. You know, some people will go to Euclideanly, like weak rotate to Euclidean space, and then they would use polar coordinates in d-dimensional Euclidean space. But I'm not doing that. I'm still staying in Minkowski space. Okay. And then the radial coordinate goes from 0 to infinity. Phi, the azimuthal angle, goes from 0 to 2 pi. And the polar angles go from 0 to pi. So we can now, so one of the thing is that, you know, these are all, this is Lorentz invariant, and also this doesn't depend on, that integral does not depend on any of the angles here. That's an important observation. And that's because, you know, p squared only depends on p0 squared and the mod of r squared. And p dot q just depends on p0 q0 and the mod of p and the mod of q and the angle between, the spatial part of p and q. So using that fact, we can actually now do the angular integrals. So somehow Lorentz invariance is deeply sort of, you know, ingrained in all of this. Then our d-dimensional integral becomes, okay, let's just do the azimuthal integral first. Then we have the integral over R. Then we have the string of angular integral. So now we use, sorry?
Yeah. How do you know that P and Q, they don't depend on pi, the product?
That's because, okay. So P on Q is P0, Q0, right?
Yeah.
Minus, say, let's call this RP dot RQ, right? So this only depends, so this is P0, Q0. This is the mod of, right? And then cosine of theta of, say, PQ, right?
Which is a function of all the angles, right?
No, it's it only depends on the, it only depends on the angle between P and Q, right?
You can choose this direction.
So okay, now we can use this. We can use some function, some properties of gamma functions. So in somewhere in your special function courses, you saw a formula like this. In our case, you know, there is no cosine. We can use this to write our integral from 0 to pi of sine of theta of k to the power of k as square root of pi. So that came, and then the ratio of gamma of k plus 1 by 2 by gamma of k plus 2 by 2. So each of these, you know, sine integrals can be written as ratios of two gamma functions. So there'll be a string of ratios multiplied by square roots of pi. And of those, you know, all of them will cancel each other except for 2. And so when we do that, we get So this is the prefactor we get is from the angular integrals. Now, there's a bit of algebra, and I'm going to refer you to the Ryder book on quantum field theory. So chapter 9, appendix A. And if you do that, then you can do this integral, and that contributes some more factors of gamma functions. And in the end, you get a result, which is so generically, alpha is a positive integer. So gamma of alpha is, you know, that poses no problem. Yeah?
Yeah? How did you do the theta integral? Like, doesn't P dot Q depend on this stuff?
Oh, right, right. So, okay. So you're saying that that P dot Q, the angle between theta P and Q will change as you change P, right?
Yeah.
Right. So you were right.
Yeah, I mean, phi is okay, but at least one of the thetas, you know, some of them are like all of them.
That's a good point, yeah.
But the question is if this thing contributes to the divergent behavior, since you always have this P0 squared minus R squared in front.
Right, is this like some kind of first order approximation or?
I don't think so. That's a good point. Let me go back and, you know, because, and look at it. And, you know, in the next lecture, I read the Ryder appendix very carefully, and he doesn't seem to, you know, it doesn't seem to have any approximations involved in this. So there is probably some. Some people, the way that they do this is that you get the same kind of result if you analytically continue to d-dimensional Euclidean space. And then you get the same result. And you, at the end of everything, you analytically continue back. And in that case, you know, your d-dimensional momentum vector is in that case, when you have
in this line, this top line last course.
Right.
This is the p dot q in the denominator. Which orientation of p is being used there?
So what do you mean orientation?
It's the same thing, but it's still, it seems like even at that point it doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
But at that point it's right.
Okay, let me, okay, hang on. So, okay, let me just go back and, you know, very, yeah.
Yeah,
question, now we're going to ask after you complete the statement.
Sorry?
I mean, now we're going to ask a question after you complete the statement.
No, no, what I was going to say is that, you know, I'm going to go back and look at this. I'm not exactly sure what's happening there, because I thought that it didn't depend, but you know, you've convinced me it does. So it may be that I wrote something wrong in the formula. So I'll just go and, you know, I'll just, you know, I'll tell you guys next time, okay? So, yeah?
Why not complete the square first and do the shift in the integral and then do the calculation? I mean, like, it is written as t squared minus 2 p dot q.
Yeah.
If I complete the square, like...
Yeah, then it doesn't become, yeah, then, yeah, I think that's the answer. Yeah. Yeah.
If q is on shell, for example, then...
No, q doesn't have to be on shell. Yeah. So, you know, what Wonjun is saying is that you basically p plus 2 p dot q is basically p squared plus 2. I think, yeah, that's probably the answer. It's q squared minus q squared. And then, you know, define this as p prime minus q squared. And then, you know, basically do the integral in terms of p prime. And then, you know, you basically, you know, we'll not have that problem, right? That's what's awesome. Thank you. Okay, so we have a few more minutes. And so alpha is generically an integer. So okay, I'm just thinking where I should write this. Let me write over here. So this is generically a positive integer. So it's a positive integer. So this thing, you know, when the gamma function in the numerator, when d is 4, becomes this, and this blows up. So this blows up. So when a alpha is, you know, less than 2 or less than 2, but an integer, and that's because the gamma functions have poles in when their arguments are negative integers. So the idea behind dimensional regularization is to say that let's take D to be 4 minus epsilon, where epsilon is a small positive quantity, a positive number. Then our gamma function will have, for small values of epsilon, it'll have an expansion of like this, where psi 1 is a constant. So gamma is a special constant which has this value, and it's called the Euler Mascheroni constant. So The point of all these calculations is that this integral, if you have identified the divergence in the integral as a pole in epsilon, right? And everything else is finite. And this is the divergence that you want to get rid of. Generically, in higher dimensions, in higher order, when you have higher loops in your diagram, there are going to be more than one of these integrals. And therefore, for higher loops, you would expect higher order poles in epsilon. So the order of the pole of the epsilon is related to what loop you are working. So let me just finish by writing down the generalization of this integral to a couple of more integrals. And these are taken from the appendix by Peskin and Schroeder. Oops, sorry. What am I doing? Let's do something over here. So these are integrals that we'll use next time. So here in Peskin, here they have done what Wonjun was saying. There are no cross terms between L and anything like delta, and that's because whatever cross term you have, there's a way in which you can actually get rid of those cross terms, and I'll present that trick next time. It's called the Feynman-Schwinger parametrization trick, and then your integrals generically take this form. So if your momentum integral is of this form, then sometimes your integrand might have two factors of momenta which are not contracted with each other. So it might be L mu, L nu. In that case, because you have integrated over your momentum, the only thing that the only tensor that this can depend on is the metric tensor. There's a few other of these forms where there are more than two factors of momentum in the numerator, and those integrals are listed in Peskin and Schroeder, and we'll use this integral next time to regularize QED. Okay, thank you.